Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
platypus milk. This is a mid-book review. I'm reading a book called Platypus, The Extraordinary Story of How a Curious Creature Baffled the World by Anne Morrell. And it's spelled M-O-Y-A-L, a really fantastic author. And at this stage, I'm looking into, in depth, the concept or the ideas associated with platypus milk and how this all fits together. So we are at a point in the story where I've just got to... A Scottish person called Caldwell, Caldwell, C-A-L-D-W-E-L-L, has come to Australia 40 years after the invention of an idea of what a scientist is, and supported by an association called the British Association for the Advancement of Science, which invented the concept of science. And he is the first real scientist on the scene. The people before him were natural philosophers and amateurs, people who had their reputations linked in with what they've said. So what they said is very much their personality. And so he came on as the first, real systematic scientist, and essentially hammered the poor old platypuses, killing hundreds and not into the thousands or into the thousands of platypus, and by an army of Koori, we call them Koori, but Aboriginal to people overseas, or natives who've come in and just got thousands and thousands of shots, shot thousands of platypus, or platypi, or platypuses, as the plural is, yes, eventually shot one where it was, had laid an egg and had another egg in the breech, and that was further proof. And then he came up with the remarkable discovery that the egg was a reptile egg, and a bird egg, and it wasn't anything like a mammal egg, or any of the mammal eggs. And mammal egg is simply, the entire egg divides in two, whereas these eggs, the division occurs outside the yolk sac, and it just feeds on the yolk, so it survives a longer time, and you get a relatively complete individual out, going across. And of course, this has had large implications for evolution as well. And so I went back and checked, and my naive understanding is that placental animals, so there's three groups of mammals. There's placentals, that's UI, cats, dogs, etc. Marsupials, kangaroos, koalas, opossums in South America, innumerable little numbats, and then there's the monotremes, of which there are only two living examples, which is our echidna, a spiny anteater, a fairly cute little character, but it's got a long beak. It's one of the things you don't really think about it. And the platypus, which also had a beak. And the implication of this is that they evolved, departed from the reptiles rather than the dinosaurs. So land life occurred on Earth 400 million years ago. There's a website which has got this beautifully displayed. Reptiles 320 million years ago, and dinosaurs 260 million years ago. The dinosaurs ruled for 120 million years. They're not reptiles, as many people would think. So we see crocodiles, they look like dinosaurs, but they are indeed reptiles, so they're more ancient form. And in fact, turtles and reptiles are much more ancient than dinosaurs. And we've got the dinosaurs now as the birds. They're the only living link with our dinosaurs, are the current day birds. And so in the platypus, the mammals evolved around 200 million years ago, and the platypus, the monotremes, or the invention of lactation was 166 million years ago, and more recently, so we have diverged from the monotremes with the invention of the teats, and I'll put a link to or put up the picture in the blog showing the separation. So we have with mammals the identification, the separation of mammals is there's two things: they produce milk, they lactate, and they have fur. I suppose one of the things that you see reading the book is people have two facts, and what they tend to do is they get fact one and fact two, and they put fact one before leading to fact two, whereas in fact they may be unrelated or they can travel together. And so I'll have this as a critique of platypus milk as we get further into this. Now, what it could be is that we have the evolution of two things, or three things eventually. One is fur, one is milk, a production of milk, and teats, now, and eventually placenta. Now, the placenta may not have an evolutionary ignition. It may have an evolutionary propulsion. Like it may have provided an evolutionary advantage, but the origin of itself is not necessarily an adaptation to environment. Maybe not. The issue here is, let us say that, just consider speculation, did lactation occur first, or fur occur first, and how are the two related? So I was just going to think that, say if you have feathers, so there's birds have, or flighted birds have evolved at the same time of the early platypuses. Still dinosaurs going around the place, are nocturnal or existing in a habitat which is hard for the dinosaurs to access. So their amphibious or land water life might be necessarily difficult for dinosaurs to access. You can imagine alligators and various things like that, or predatory fish, which we have at, we know about at that stage. We've had a nice meal of the platypus. So the platypus's shyness may not be due to today's animals, but may have been due to prehistoric predators that they had to escape or outwit. But the overall view is the evolution of fur and the evolution of lactation, are they at all related? And we simply don't know. However, if you were to lactate into feathers, I would expect that because the feathers have a complex function, that the secretion. So in general, I don't know whether birds produce scents through glands. So it's the entire issue of secretions, and of course the secretion glands. Now you can also imagine snakes or scales. Now fish produce lots of secretions. They produce slime on their scales, and the lungfish can produce large amounts of secretions. It's whether this is a nutritious secretion and its interaction. So its interaction is secretion, not to smell, not to blend in with the body, but to move out for a certain area. So one of the things I would say, that if you've got fur, the secretions do not move easily around the body. They tend to go through the fur and out of the fur. This is the very early things. So I think that the nutritious secretion and fur link together in some sort of way. So I think my guess is that fur evolved first, and then lactation into fur kept the actual lactation stuff, stopped it moving around, it sort of held it in an area. So say if it's the reptile, it would, as far as I could see, would lactate and it would immediately go into the environment. The fur sort of held it in proximity for a reasonable amount of time, such that the animals could eat for it. So I think the evolution of fur led to lactation, and we have the long-term evolution after that of teats. These are specialist things where the mouth goes to the teat. Now, of course, the beak and teat don't go together. So the monotremes, who had an advantage due to beaks, the use of beaks, have survived. And so it's that they've had a solution package of beak and no teat as a package, because the beak provided such a evolutionary advantage in their habitat. The anteater using the beak to go into ant mounds, and the platypus using its beak to actually, as a sophisticated sensor in the aquatic life, meant that the advantage wasn't there. But scientists have looked at platypus milk, because milk has antibiotic properties. In fact, it actually has active white cells which protect the nascent immune system, which is rebooting, or is booting. Now, there's a reason why antibodies and immune systems don't transfer to infants, is that this transfer process can easily be hijacked by viruses. So you can, if you don't sort of reboot the immune system with each new individual, well, firstly, it's only a few cells that the pathogens can't really necessarily get in there. But there's another reason that you don't want to transport foreign genetic information from species to species, and there's the advantage of rebooting. Again, so unknown to many people, besides the nutritional value of milk, there's the antibody value of milk. And there's a museum up here, an artist's house, and they made this comment that they used to pour milk on the kitchen floor each day to clean it, and that milk was used as an antibiotic, a cleaning agent. There's a bit of a curious, but it does, in fact, if you put milk into bacterial culture, what generally happens is the bacterial culture struggles to get going. It's not as advantageous. It's not a antibiotic, but it is an antibacterial. And so with the platypus, there's a major problem, because the teat has got a natural hygiene associated with it. It's sort of, the milk goes into the mouth and it's environmentally protected. So with the platypus, the milk goes out into the open, and therefore a lot of bacteria. So the milk goes into the water, and the platypus, the pug, actually eats when it's swimming. So when it's really young, it obviously eats it from the actual mother's fur, but a bit later on, when the milk is secreted in the water, the milk is in the water and it drinks it from the water. Obviously, as it does that, there's bacteria which can get into it. And so the CSIRO has, that's our Commonwealth Research, Scientific and Industrial and Scientific Research Organisation, which is sort of our premier body, research, government-funded research body, has looked at the antibacterial property let's see, of the platypus milk. And lo and behold, they found this large protein. It's been a fascinating article to read, because they've tested this protein and found that it has had antibacterial bodies. And there's graphs up there where they have a control with a dish with no bacteria, a dish with bacteria, a dish with just where you just add the medium, and where you add successively increased concentrations of the milk. And you can see through this that it does 50 micrograms per milliliter or something very, very small of this large organic compound. It does inhibit the antibacterial property. And they've said, well, this is a protein and it has antibacterial property to it, which is sort of very interesting. It's like replaying the entire scientific debate, because as a review, as a scientist, what I would have done is I would have had the complete milk and the antibiotic material property, the complete the protein under question, which they've called the Shirley Temple protein, because they've noted a lot of circular curls of protein. The protein is highly curled. Now, this is actually quite standard for a globulin. The protein is a very large protein, how I would have done it is I would have compared it, the protein by itself, the protein with the milk, to see if there's other what's the antibiotic bacterial property. So what they do is they've got these captive platypuses, and they milk them. I think what the article says is that they inject them with oxytocin, which is a milk producing hormone. So it's very interesting that this ancient animal has got the same hormone that women have today. So I would have done it like that way. And then it's got this property, but it also has the property, it's so large, it's got so many proteins in it, it could also be a source of nutrition. It may have three or four properties associated with it. It may be a cofactor, an antibiotic or an antibacterial cofactor. All these complex answers. So they've answered one question which supports the minimum amount of research they can do to produce a paper. But in terms of questioning where they go, there's so many different tests that you could have done. So essentially, it's a fairly simple test that they've done, is that the particular bacteria that they're fighting is a fluorescent bacteria, and so they can just shine a UV light upon it and count the amount of bacteria by the fluorescent signal strength, and sort of running it side by side. So there's just so many factors for it, and whether the actual so many hours in, does the protein survive? There's just so many questions to ask in that. Like, you should put 50 milligrams of protein in at 50 out, at, I don't know, 8 hours going in. But you should also then put in the sample of protein which has been hanging around for 8 hours to put it in. I don't know whether that's the situation. There's so many different combinations going ahead. So this is sort of the next generation of science, saying there are so many possibilities to go across. It's this fundamental idea of two facts and how they're causal links. And if you study the maths of it and assemble facts in a matrix, there's things called simplex algebra, where the facts can go both ways. It's the maximum possible amount of information which you could extract from facts, that is, this is for related to lactation, positively or negatively. Did one happen before or the after? it's a large protein? Is it an energy source or a protein source in milk? The biological activity really has to be, you could do it separate, but is it different, separate from in combination? So there's so much to go. I'll put a link to the Cicero article. But it's very interesting that as a scientist, you can recognize as soon as a scientist comes on the scene and the type of information that he reports, it's not an embryo, it's not an egg, but it's definitely a reptile egg inside. A reptile bird egg as opposed to a mammal egg coming out. So that's his first report. And so that's sort of a singular link of information that he's reported on. But now, as we go up and start to backtrack and ask these questions and do these analysis of things like platypus milk itself, we are ready really for the next stage of science, of where we can actually map a paper and say, how many questions did that paper ask? And in this case, this paper asked only a simple question. Does this protein have antibiotic, antibacterial properties? Yes, it does, but does any protein do it? How does it compare with a protein of a singular molecular weight? How does it compare with an old protein, young protein? How does it compare with a group of proteins mixed inside there? You know, it's absence or addition to platypus milk, which is reinforced with it. And practically, what does it mean? Similarly in there, does it have a nutritional value? Does it have a enzyme value? Does it promote certain reactions across from it? But that tended to go from the news grabbing, saying that it's got these coily coils inside it, these very distinctive coils, it's trying to link those coils with an antibacterial factor, and what would be the mechanism behind it. That's another quick midterm review. And I'll get about getting my kids to school. Thanks for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.